Welcome, everyone, to the House Committee on Human Services and Housing. Today is April 4th, 2017, Manufactured Homes Day. We're going to start off with a quick work session on House Bill 2964. So open the work session. Cassie, please read the summary.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2964 extends city approval of applications for limited property tax exemption to existing single unit housing that is purchased, rehabilitated, or newly constructed. The bill is effective the 91st day following sine die. We have the fiscal impact. There is no fiscal impact, and the revenue requires further analysis. And there is a subsequent referral to the House Committee on Revenue.
So, Madam Chair, are you sure you want to do this?
Mm-hmm.
Start the morning. All right. So, Madam Chair, I move House Bill 2964 to the floor with the due pass recommendation, and that the bill be referred to the House Committee on Revenue by prior reference.
Vice Chair Olson moves House Bill 2964 to the floor with a due pass recommendation, and that the bill be referred to the House Committee on Revenue by prior reference. Any discussion? Just to remind you, and I think Representative Meek may be the only one from this committee on the bill, that this is it's permissive. It allows cities, if they want, to exempt certain homes for rehab. So right now they can exempt certain homes that have not yet been constructed, but these are for ones that have been constructed. And it's similar to in intent to the one after this that we did not get the amendment back in time for, but they're both ways to try to encourage more rehabilitation of units if cities so choose. So would you like to add anything?
Thank you, Madam Chair. That I think it's another tool that we've been working on this year for affordable housing, and it will be an opportunity for home buyers to be able to get into a home at an affordable rate, an incentive, and just another great opportunity.
Yep. Great. Okay, thank you. Any other discussion? Any objection? Oh, whoops. Can't. I'm not doing an amendment. Sorry. Could you please take the call the roll?
Yes.
Aye.
Representative Nierman?
Aye.
Representative Noble?
Aye.
Representative
Luso?
Aye.
Representative Stark?
Yes.
Vice Chair Olson?
Aye.
Vice Chair Sanchez?
Aye.
Chair
Kittygaard? Aye. House Bill 2964 moves to revenue.
Yes.
And I close the work session. I am going to open the work session on House Bill 2210 for the purpose of carrying it over to Thursday, April 6th at 8 a.m. Because we have an amendment that further defines what affordable is, and that should be coming soon. We'll be ready by then. So close the work session on House Bill 2010. Open a public hearing on House Bills 2990, 2008, 3331, 3330. We're going to hear all of them at once so that when you come up, you can refer to whichever one you'd like to refer to, all of them or any one of them. So Representatives Fahey and Marsh. And Cassie, can you please read? We'll have Cassie read the summary of all the bills.
Okay. House Bill 2990 allows tenants, communities to purchase manufactured dwelling parks without competition and allows tenants 60 days to form the committee, notify the park owner in writing, and request financial information about the park. The bill allows tenants committees right of first refusal for any offer or agreement by the owner to sell the park for 15 days following the tenants committee's notice to the owner of intent to purchase. The bill requires park owners to negotiate in good faith with the tenants committee and applies to notices of owner's intent to sell dated on or after the bill's effective date. House Bill 2008 requires landlord of a manufactured dwelling park when closing the park to convert to other use to pay the greater of either necessary relocation costs or the applicable park closure penalty as determined by the Manufactured Communities Resource Center. The bill allows local governments to enact and enforce policies requiring landlords to pay penalties or relocation costs in addition to these requirements. The bill defines necessary relocation costs as the total cost of repair, hiring a service to move, and installing the dwelling at a new location, and required insurance or permits, and specifies the time in which the landlord is required to pay the tenant for the penalty or necessary relocation costs. The bill requires an owner of a park to give written notice to the manufactured community's resource center of interest in selling the park prior to marketing the park for sale, and requires the owner to provide notice of final sale to the manufactured community's resource center. The bill specifies information required to be in the final sale notice. The bill also establishes requirements for terminating tenancy of month-to-month and fixed-term tenancies for manufactured dwelling parks, and requires the manufactured community's resource center to produce materials to inform tenants of rights and adopt rules requiring landlords to post rules, and requires the manufactured community's resource center to establish and administer landlord-tenant dispute resolution programs. And declares an emergency effective on passage. We have both a dash one and a dash two amendment for House Bill 2008. The dash one requires the manufactured community's resource center to determine by rule the amount of manufactured dwelling park closure penalties to be paid to the landlords by landlords to tenants, and specifies that the penalties to not be less than specified amounts applicable to the size of the manufactured dwelling. The amendment clarifies language for lien holder and cooperative transfers of the manufactured dwelling title. The dash two clarifies information required for registering a manufactured dwelling park within Housing and Community Services, and requires OHCS to publish a biennial report on the manufactured dwelling park registration. House Bill 3331 requires the Office of Manufactured Dwelling Park Community Relations to establish and administer a landlord-tenant dispute program, resolution program. It makes the dispute resolution program available to manufactured dwelling park tenants if the tenant receives a rent increase notice of more than 1% above the specified consumer price index, and a majority of tenants agree to dispute the increase. The bill specifies the processes for initiation, mediation, and resolution of the dispute resolution program. House Bill 3330 allows a local government to impose rent controls on rental rates and increases for manufactured dwellings or floating homes.
Thank you. Good morning, Chair Kenny Geyer and members of the committee. My name is Julie Fahey. I'm the state representative from House District 14, which covers West Eugene and Junction City. And I'm here today with Representative Marsh to talk about our bills related to manufactured housing and the challenges that are unique to that form of housing in this state. Manufactured housing, mobile homes, are a very important source of affordable housing in Oregon. In 2015, the average cost to purchase a new single-wide mobile home was $50,000, and the average cost for a double-wide was $83,000. This reflects a price per square foot that's about half that of a conventionally built home. There are about 140,000 manufactured homes in Oregon, and 62,000 of them are sited in one of over 1,000 parks registered in the state. Residents of these parks typically own their home and rent the space on which it is sited. ORS Chapter 90 has a specific section that deals with landlord-tenant law in both manufactured houses and in parks and floating homes in marinas. For example, this section dictates that, unlike most renters, manufactured homeowners in parks are already protected from no-cause evictions. The Manufactured Community Resource Center under Oregon Housing and Community Services is responsible for helping the tenants of manufactured homes understand their rights under Oregon law. MCRC registers parks and maintains a directory of all manufactured home parks in the state. They also currently have a dispute resolution program service to mediate conflicts between landlords and tenants. Any issues around evictions, property disputes, neighbor disputes, that sort of thing. Lane and Jackson counties have the most number of mobile home parks in the entire state, so that's why Representative Marsh and I are in front of you today. We both have a large number of parks in our districts, and we have seen firsthand some of the challenges that our constituents in these parks face. I'm going to focus a little bit on just the challenges that relate specifically to the bills that we have in front of us today. First, despite their name, mobile homes are actually not very mobile. It can cost upwards of $20,000 to move a unit, and often a home's age or condition makes moving it impossible. Because tenants cannot relocate as easily as apartment renters, in practice, the manufactured housing market is not a true free market. Many park residents are low-income families or seniors on fixed incomes, and large unexpected rent increases can be financially devastating to park residents living on fixed incomes. Residents who can't afford a space rent increase face the choice of either selling their homes, potentially at a substantial loss, abandoning it, or are making sacrifices in things like food and prescription medication. Because of the large number of seniors that live in manufactured housing, you'll see that AARP Oregon has submitted written testimony on behalf of HB 3330 and 3331. Another challenge is that there's currently no enforcement mechanism for violations of the landlord-tenant law. In Washington, the Department of Justice is the enforcement agency, but in Oregon, there's no state agency that has enforcement authority. Tenants are not always fully informed of their rights, and low-income tenants are often less able to obtain legal representation than park owners can be in the case of legal action. Park closures are somewhat rare, but when a park closes, current law requires that park owners must pay tenants some of their relocation expenses. However, the required amounts prescribed in law have never been updated to reflect inflation. One of the issues we've seen in recent years has to do with the sale of parks, particularly with large companies buying parks in Oregon. Many of these companies are from California and are interested in Oregon parks because we have fewer regulations on manufactured housing. In the case of a park sale, current law requires owners to give tenants notice when a park goes on the market. The tenants then have 10 days to decide whether or not to pursue purchasing the park themselves, which is a very short period of time to make that decision. We believe that tenant ownership is one of the best ways to preserve this source of affordable housing. Thank you all for the opportunity to testify today, and I'm going to hand it over to Representative Marsh.
Thank you. Good morning, Chair Kinney-Geyer, members of the committee. I'm Pam Marsh. I'm representative from House District 5, which is the other end of the state, Southern Jackson County, Ashland, Talon, Phoenix, corner of Medford, and out to the Applegate Valley. I wanted to just start off this morning by telling you a little story that kind of renewed my passion for this whole subject area. I'd been involved in mobile home issues probably 30 years ago in California when the urbanization of the Bay Area really started to push out mobile home parks that had been there for decades. But then a year ago, this issue came back to focus because our city attorney, who also does some work on the side, told me the story of Ralph Garcia. Ralph Garcia is a resident of Shady Cove, which is a tiny little community in Jackson County. In 2012, Ralph, who is a single father of four children, bought a mobile home in the Shady Cove Mobile Home Park. He was happy there for 2 years, and then all of a sudden, over the span of that period, his rent went from $265 to $880 in a two-year span. He was a low-income worker, as a single parent, Ralph couldn't afford that. He was forced to move out to take his four children, to leave his home, which, as Representative Fay noted, it's a misnomer to suggest that mobile homes are actually mobile. Now, in Ralph's case, he's actually lucky because he and his children wound up in subsidized housing in the kinds of environment we have right now. We have to consider that a big win. But as a result, he was forced to basically abandon his mobile home, which was then taken over by the owner of the park. It seems entirely unconscionable that in this day and age that a rent increase could afford, could require a family to basically abandon their equity in a home that they have managed to put together for their family. But that's exactly what happened in Ralph's case. So with that context, I really started looking at issues generally that affect our mobile home park residents. And as Julie noted, in Jackson County, we have 104 parks. So it's a significant source of affordable housing. We bring to you today a little suite of bills, and if you turn the fact sheet that's in front of you over to the other side, and we'll note as well that this is posted on OLIS for anyone who wants to look it up, and I'm going to walk you through these bills. To start with, House Bill 2008, which I consider kind of a consumer bill of rights, and this bill has been amended several times, so the fact sheet is really sort of your best indicator as to what's currently in the bill. The bill has six significant provisions. First, it would update the required relocation payments to tenants when a park closes. Current law requires $5,000, $7,000, and $9,000 corresponding to single, double, or triple white homes. This bill would require those numbers simply to be updated. They haven't been changed since they were put into law some years ago. So that it would then be $6,000, $8,000, or $10,000 or actual reimbursements of real costs up to a maximum of $20,000. Secondly, it would require park owners, when a park is sold, to notify the Manufactured Communities Resource Center, essentially an office in the state, of the date of sale, price, purchaser, and number of vacant spaces. We simply need to have data. Who owns these parks? Who can we go to when there is an issue? Third, it would require the state, or MCRC, to prepare handouts regarding tenant rights, containing a toll-free complaint number and an explanation of the complaint process. Fourth, it would instruct MCRC to maintain a database about complaints made against landlords. Fifth, it would require additional data during the annual park registration process, essentially giving us the kind of data that we need to be able to make policy decisions in the future. And finally, it would establish an enforcement process through MCRC for both landlords and tenants to investigate violations and make determinations and impose penalties. Right now, we do have a complaint process, but there's no enforcement. So essentially, it's a process that really doesn't work for tenants who have a legitimate complaint against a landlord. So that's House Bill 2008. Again, I think of it as the Consumer Bill of Rights, just solidifying some of the rights that tenants have when they live in a mobile home park. The second bill we wanted to present to you is House Bill 2990. And this bill would give tenants first right of refusal when a park goes on the market. When I looked at Ralph Garcia's problems and the issues that are really imposed upon tenants of a mobile home park in terms of their inability to really move their home when rent prices go up, I realized that the most empowering thing that we could do for these tenants is to simply take them out of a relationship with a landlord. That is, to put those parks whenever possible either in the hands of a tenant through a cooperative or in the hands of a nonprofit or a housing authority that's acting on behalf of the tenants. Right now, what we do is pretty minimal. We require owners who are putting a park on a market to give 10 days of notice to tenants and to also notify the state that the park is going on the market. 10 days, if you're a group of tenants who haven't seen this coming, who haven't organized, is really insufficient amount of time to talk to your neighbors, to organize, to seek out, to reach out for help. 2990 would make it clear that tenants have the opportunity to simply compete, fair market value, to simply be first in line to see if they can put an offer together to purchase that park. So that's HB 2990. And then Representative Fay, I'm going to hand it back to you to go through 3330 and 3331.
All right, thank you. 3330 basically just lifts the preemption on rent control just for manufactured homes and parks and floating homes and marinas, so cities and counties could set their own rent stabilization policies. And then 3331, MCRC already has a mediation program that mediates different disputes, and I've heard a number of reports that that program works pretty well. But space rent increases are not among the things that can be talked about in that mediation program. So this 3331 would add space rent to the list of things that can be mediated, but it also includes some protections that it actually has to be above a certain threshold. So it can't be any space increase. It has to be 1 percentage point above consumer price index.
So those are the bills we bring to you today. We know that there is a consortium of owners and tenants that are meeting together on a regular basis to address issues in our mobile home communities. We think it is important to put in front of you what we believe are best practices for governing those relationships and protecting the tenants who live in those parks.
Great. Any questions for the representatives?
Yes, thank you. Thank you, Chair Kenny Geyer. These bills, did any of these bills go through, and the proper name is slipping my mind, but the Landlord-Tenant Coalition Group for Manufactured Homes that usually bills go
through?
And
that group, that's what I was referring to in my earlier comments. We have met with the organizers of that group. That group was disbanded for several months back in the fall when these bills were really coming together. They've since started meeting again. We think that's a positive, very positive advance. We, again, realize that some of these bills probably need consideration by that group because we want to support, whenever possible, collaboration. I think that's a good move forward. At the same time, it seems important to really set a bar. And I think that's what these bills do, is to again set out what we believe would be best practices.
Thank you for that question, and I just want to ditto what you said. I think it's really important to have the coalition. I really regretted when it broke down this fall. I think many of you in the audience are probably part of that coalition. In the face of that, as a housing committee, it was really important that we not let that kind of thing stop our consideration of issues that we continue to hear when we go door to door, and as we represent everyone in our community. And so, I actually encouraged people to continue to bring issues forward, so I just want to make sure that the message is very clear. If there's not a coalition, we are going to continue to hear message. So please, please, please keep the coalition together, continue to work together, because products are always better when you really have a good forum to hear from all sides.
Can I?
Yes, please.
Thank you, Chair Kinnegar. I would just add to that, you know, I've gone door to door and talked with people, all of the parks in my district, and these are the issues that I'm hearing about. And so, you know, in the absence of an active coalition, we put forth bills that we felt like were best for our constituents. So
that's right.
And if I could also add a comment.
Yes, please do.
I think it's important to realize that the practices that we're trying to address go on and on. We just had a mobile home park. It was in the newspaper and the Mail Tribune in Medford. In our community, bought by out-of-state Southern California investment interests. I simply think whenever possible, we need to have the opportunity to get tenants into that equation. It's ridiculous to have parks in Jackson County owned by people who aren't on the ground, who don't see what happens, and who basically leave tenants vulnerable potentially to unfavorable practices.
And we know there's great manufactured home park owners, and there's some that really need, you know, that, which is why we need tight regulation. There's all kinds out there. So thank you so much for bringing these ideas forward. And that was a good segue to the next panel, which will be Chuck Carpenter and John Van Landingham, representing the coalition.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. What is my name? John Van Landingham. Where am I? So I work as a lawyer for the Oregon Law Center and have been a legal aid lawyer for almost 40 years, during which I have represented tenants. That includes manufactured home park tenants. Representative Fahey described the distinctive status of a manufactured home park tenant. They are not mobile. They, by the way, prefer that you call them manufactured homes, not mobile homes. They're very protective of their status as homeowners because they do own their homes. They rent the space. During the past 20 years, I've worked very closely as a facilitator and draftsperson for a group of manufactured home park owner advocates and owners and residents and resident advocates. And we have produced a negotiated bill in every legislative session during those 20 years. That's 10 sessions in a row. We are working on a bill this session, Senate Bill 277, which is on the Senate side, which hopefully will get to you. We're meeting today at 10:30 to try to finalize Senate Bill 277. I also serve on the board of Manufactured Housing / Oregon State Tenants Association, OSTA, which is the statewide association of park residents. And the board president, Rita Loberger, is in the audience behind me. I want to say that I very much appreciate the concerns identified by Representatives Fahey and Marsh. There are a lot of good ideas in those bills. Chuck Carpenter and I met with the two of them last night at 5, from 5 to 6. We talked about whether there's a way to move forward with a compromise on H-Bill B 2008. I hope there is, at least as we left the room last night at 6 p.m., there seemed to be. Chuck has to review those things with his board, and he'll talk about that. But that compromise would include a couple of simpler items from the list that Representative Fahey read to you that's in OLIS. For example, increasing the payments when a landlord closes a park. Those payments currently are $5,000, $7,000, $9,000 based on the size of the home. Those figures were set in 2007. So they haven't been changed since 2007. It makes sense to increase them roughly. If you increase them by the CPI since 2007, they'd go to 6, 8, and 10. And then the idea would be in the bill is to index those going forward with the Housing Community Services Department, MCRC, adopting that by rule with CPI. So that's something I think we can agree to. There's some other things in there that we can agree to. There are some amendments in the Dash 1 amendments to 2008, which would benefit park resident co-ops. One of the best strategies, Representative Marsh talked about the value of having residents own their own homes. One of the best strategies that we found for that, we've been working on this since 2005, to encourage park resident purchases, is to form something called a manufactured dwelling park nonprofit cooperative. And there are about 10 of those in the state at this point. CASA is the primary nonprofit that helps set those up. And the opportunity to purchase statutes fit with that. That's part of one of the issues that are in the bills that Reps Fahey and Marsh have brought. CASA has a couple of proposals in the Dash 1 that would make it easier for the Manufactured Dwelling Park Nonprofit Co-op to work with a lender. And we would support putting those into an amended to the House Bill 2008. We've also made a commitment last night, and we've already started this anyway without this, that the coalition would work on the enforcement issue. It's the top priority for residents, and on improvements to opportunity to purchase. There were opportunity to purchase statutes, which were adopted in 2014 after the work of a legislative work group co-chaired by Representatives Nathanson and Wisnett. That product passed the House 60-0. In 2014, creating the opportunity to purchase statutes. There are some things that could be improved with that. We had already identified that as something we want to work on, and we've made a commitment to work on those. There are a couple of other ideas in the list that Representative Fahey showed you that we're also open to working on. I'd be happy to take questions after Chuck speaks.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Chuck Carpenter. I'm the Executive Director of Manufactured Housing Communities of Oregon. We represent about 541 manufactured home communities in the state of Oregon. And I'd just like to make some overall comments, not really specific to the legislation proposals that are before you. But I've been involved in the Manufactured Housing Coalition since 1999. This year will be the 10th coalition bill that I will have been a part of, that MHCO has been a part of, and I hope that it's not the last one that we do. You all have, over the years, the legislative body has acknowledged the importance of the coalition, and I think it's important that we move forward in that spirit. We have addressed some very, very significant issues over the last 20 years since I've been part of this process. We addressed elimination of subsequent sale. We did disrepair and deterioration. We've done a change in how leases end in the state of Oregon, how they morph into either another lease or a month-to-month rental agreement. We've done mandatory training. We've done rent history. Landlords are not required to give an applicant who comes into their community and becomes a resident a five-year history of what the rent is in that community over the last 5 years. We've done one of my favorite topics, water submetering, which we talked about ad nauseum, and we've not gotten right, to be honest with you, and we need to go back and revisit that issue. We've dealt with right of first refusal or opportunity to purchase. Very contentious issue. We can't even agree on what to call it. So if you talk to a homeowner, they will call it opportunity to purchase. If you talk to a landlord, they will call it right of first refusal. And now we're dealing with disrepair and deterioration part two, and I was part of the original process back in 1999. All these issues have some things in common. In the beginning, they were extremely contentious. We were able to reach a compromise. And finally, nobody got everything that they wanted in that compromise. Many, many times in the last 20 years, we've walked away from the table, or the homeowners have walked away from the table, very unhappy. And I guess as the saying goes, if everybody's unhappy, then we've probably done a pretty good job. But we provide an excellent product. I mean, we talk about these issues ad nauseum. We probably talked about opportunity to purchase, right of first refusal for 3 years. At the end, I think everybody was unhappy with the product, but it was a good product in terms of the industry. And I think we did better than we could have if we were limited to just sitting here and giving you 3 minutes of testimony on that topic. So I just want to encourage all of you to recognize the work that we try to do to come up with good solutions. It is important that both parties, or all parties, sometimes the lenders need to be part of the process, that we be at the table and that we be talking. And from my standpoint and from MHCO's standpoint, I promise you that we will always be there and we will negotiate in good faith. That does not mean that we're going to agree on everything that is in those bills. There's some things in there that we are absolutely, we find appalling and we could not support. But we're willing to talk and try to find a way to come up with finding a solution. We're one of the last consensus groups in this building, in this political process. When I was a legislator in 95 and 97, we had a much better job of having people work together to find the common ground, to find the reasonable solutions that turn out a good product. And I think we're sort of the last ones left. And I think that's really unfortunate. So some other comments I want to make to you today, just very briefly. We are affordable housing. We are what you in this state and in this body want and need. It is what we've been talking about since the beginning of the session. We've been talking about it for much longer than that. We are not the problem. We are not Portland. We are not giving $200 or $300 rent increases. Our rents are typically $200 or $300. And I'm sorry to hear what the good representative said earlier about the $800 rent, and we'd be happy to take a look at that. And I've provided you with a breakout. It's 8 pages broken out by county of what, for the most part, for our members, what the rent is and what it has been over the last 5 years. And I encourage you to take a look at that. That's important data. It shows us what's going on in most parks. There's always going to be outliers. But we are the solution that you are looking for. And the regulation that you've come out with, or proposed regulation that you've come out with this year, has sort of left a lot of community owners shaking their head like, wow, I thought we were part of the solution. I thought we were what this legislature wants. And a lot of people who own communities and are providing this important service, to be honest with you, they're not feeling the love lately. They see this legislation as being very hostile and as reasons for them to exit the business and to sell their park to large corporations, which is probably not in anyone's interest in this room. So I encourage you to help us preserve this very important piece of affordable housing. Landlords face the same problems every day that this committee faces in your hearings. We face elder abuse. We face drug dealers who live next to elderly people who are scared, and the landlord tries to work to get those people evicted, but it happens that that drug dealer has an 85-year-old mom living with them, and you can't bifurcate. So if you get rid of the drug dealer, the 85-year-old mom goes with them. They deal with heart-wrenching issues in their community. These are microcosms of the real world and all the issues that you've been hearing about since this legislature convened. So we recognize there's bad players out there. We recognize that at times we need to come together and we need to have a coalition to try to find solutions to these problems. But they are not easy solutions. They are very complicated. And the best thing we can do is to talk through these things, educate our members, educate homeowners, make sure homeowners understand what their rights are, make sure landlords know what their rights are. But I want you all to know today that we are committed to continuing to provide affordable housing that is good for people, to try to address people's problems, just like you try to the best of our ability. And we are committed to working with John Van Landingham and the Homeowners Association to make sure that we find ways to come up with these problems. They're not going to go away. We'll probably be here 20 years from now. I won't be here 20 years from now. Are you going to be here 20 years from now? these problems aren't going to go away. But I am, will tell you that MHCO is committed to trying to find common sense, good solutions. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions or comments? Well, thank you very much, and I really am delighted that it is picked up and going again, because I think what you said is exactly right, and I know that you have a training day today as well. So there are a couple of places where you didn't toot your own horn.
About 100 people over the convention center.
Yeah.
Right now.
So not only do you work very hard to come up with policy solutions and provide that kind of dialogue throughout the year so that you can come to us and present, and I've been on the side of many of those coalition bills, and I can tell you that when it's not contentious and it's really been talked through, it's a hell of a lot easier to vote on those kinds of things. So thank you for all that work. But outside of the policy arena, I know you do a lot of training. And so that's very important, too, to clarify what rights, responsibilities, are for the home park owners. With that regard, you haven't had a chance to review a lot of these, I think, with your board, but I do hope that one of the things that you take very seriously is the database piece, adding a collection of information, because not only is that helpful for us in saying what rises to the top in terms of the biggest concerns from all sides that we should really deal with, but also for your training. It really feeds back into the training. So that is something that I personally, in this list of things, I think it's really, it's hard to make good policy decisions when you don't have the data. The second thing I was going to say, where I think you should toot your own horn more, is that through training and other methods, you really try to raise the standard of your industry voluntarily. You'd like to avoid any kind of regulation, so it's way better to do it voluntarily. So that can be done through training and other ways. And I'm just curious in that regard, when you hear stories and if we have a more consistent database collection on complaints, this may be easier for you to deal with. But when you hear the kind of anecdotal stories about Ralph Garcia and his rent almost quadrupling in 4 years and losing his equity in a home, what are the ways that your coalition tries to deal with it? Is it kind of a one-on-one negotiating with your communication with park owners?
In some of these circumstances, when we hear about these situations, if they're a member of the association, I try to have a board member go in and find out what is going on. And sometimes there's three sides to a story. And we try to, then I think we've talked with John Van Landingham, try to find out where, is there something here we need to do, or is this just an outlier that does not require some sort of policy solution? But we do take people acting inappropriately and not following the law very seriously.
Because I would think there'd be a lot of peer pressure also for the industry that doesn't want to have a bad name,
to
really.
And I think one of the things, Pat Schwach, years ago, what was she called, grass fire, or that we would.
One of the putting out the fires.
Putting out the fires is the first thing we do in coalition for the 3-hour meetings that we have is usually a half hour or so of talking about what's going on out there. I mean, landlords have problems too with residents, talking about how can best address these things. So, and I think it all gives us a good idea of where we're going and where the problems are.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Great. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay, so we've got 4 people that came from over 100 miles away. Joyce Jensen and Stephanie Lynn and Rich Delaney. Oh, they want to go together? So how about Charles Ricker? So Joyce Jensen, Stephanie Lynn, and Charles Ricker. Okay.
Good morning, Chair Kenny Geyer, members of the committee. My name is Joyce Jensen. I own a manufactured home in Longview Hills in Newport, and I'm the president of our community's Oregon State Tenants Association chapter. I'm here this morning in support of House Bill 2008 and to speak about the critical need for enforcement of Chapter 90 statutes. Without enforcement, a landlord has little or no incentive to obey the law, And when a landlord violates the law, a park resident has no recourse other than to hire an attorney and go to court. Many cannot afford to do this. Many Oregon parks are owned by California corporate landlords, and Oregon park residents are suffering due to the lack of enforcement. We are homeowners on rented land. We are working families with children, the Safeway clerk who checks your groceries, the server at your favorite restaurant. In the senior parks, we volunteer. We're retirees from nursing, education, and law enforcement. Many are on a fixed income. Today, I want to share the story with you of my neighbors, Bobby and Carmen Dean. Bobby is 87 years old. Carmen is 80. Last fall, their 54-year-old daughter, Elizabeth, came to live with them. Our park rules require that any guest staying over 30 days reports and registers at the park office. Following the rules, Bobby took Elizabeth to register upon her arrival. 2 months later, something happened, and the park manager called Bobby into her office and said that if he and Carmen wanted their daughter to continue living in the home, the management would be terminating their 99-year rental agreement. He was given two options. He could sign a 5-year agreement that contains capital expenditure pass-throughs that can be levied without his consent, and an illegal and unenforceable provision agreeing to forego his rights under Chapter 90. His second option was a month-to-month agreement, subject to rent increases every 90 days. He was told that if he wanted to keep his current rental agreement, his daughter would have to leave the home, and a decision was required just after Christmas. Letters were exchanged between Bobby's attorney and the landlord. When the landlord didn't reply to Bobby's January letter, Bobby believed the matter was settled. 2 months went by, and the landlord's attorney wrote to inform Bobby that his daughter would be now required to sign a temporary occupancy agreement in order to remain in the home. Tired of the emotional and financial burden that this had become on this couple, Bobby gave in. He took Elizabeth to the park office, and he registered her as her parents' caregiver. The park manager then told Bobby that due to her caregiver status, Elizabeth is now no longer allowed to go anywhere in the park unless accompanied by her parents. She may only enter the clubhouse to retrieve the mail. Elizabeth doesn't drive, and this restriction effectively makes her a prisoner within the home. Elizabeth has been an active member of our community since her arrival last fall, and she often takes long walks on our park's trails. But because of the restriction of the caregiver status, she can no longer use our park trails. Now that her movements within the park have been so severely restricted, Bobby has contacted his attorney, another attorney expense, to ask the landlord to grant a waiver for his daughter to be able to walk on the streets of our park unaccompanied. The fear and anxiety that this has caused for this couple in their 80s, their daughter, and all of the rest of us who've watched this situation unfold over the last 4 months is indescribable. You can't imagine what it feels like to live under the threat that somebody can restrict your movements that way or have the power to put you out of your home. And then to Mr. Carpenter's comments about the leases that morph into month-to-month agreements, another neighbor in my park, whose rental agreement had expired well over a year earlier, received a letter from the landlord in January telling her that if she wished to continue to rent her lot, she needed to make a decision going forward, that the landlord was now requiring her to sign a 5-year agreement, the same one, capital expenditure pass-throughs, the agreement to forego her rights under Chapter 90, and she had to do it within a couple of days. She only had 6 days to do it. But because her lease had expired, that letter was in violation of 90545, which states very clearly that when a rental agreement expires, it automatically renews as a month-to-month tenancy, having the same terms and conditions, not necessarily the rent, but the same terms and conditions. It's a month-to-month. This woman was fearful that she would be forced to move from the home she owns. It's a gorgeous, double-wide mobile home overlooking the ocean. The inside of it looks like a gallery. She's an artist. Beautiful home. Immaculately maintained. But she was afraid she was going to have to give up her home if she didn't comply with this demand letter. So she called me. We found her an attorney. She had to write a letter, pay an attorney, to get the landlord to back down. The letter she received was chilling. These are not isolated incidents, and they are occurring regularly in parks all over this state. We Oregon homeowners who rent our land are in a vulnerable position, and without enforcement, many are often easily intimidated with complying with a landlord's demand, and they're fearful they'll be evicted if they don't. The problem is not going away, and it will continue to get worse unless we get enforcement of Chapter 90. Having a database where complaints can be registered is vital. There is nothing out there. We have the laws. There's no enforcement. Our park recently changed hands last year from one California corporate owner to another. Things got worse. People are afraid. 17 written complaints to our new owner to illustrate the abusiveness of the manager in our park went unanswered for 4 months. This woman is poorly trained. She is abusive. There was one incident with her husband and a tenant where the tenant, the husband, the park manager's husband, felt that this tenant had not come to a complete stop at a stop sign. He jumped in his big red pickup truck. He chased her down. He took his vehicle, stopped in front of her vehicle to keep her from going anywhere, and began screaming and cursing at her about not coming to a complete stop. She was terrified. The only way she could have escaped this man was to crawl out of the passenger seat of her car. Enforcement is critical. Seeing these living like this is appalling. It's terrifying. And when this ripples through a park, the impact is devastating on people. So, thank you for letting me share. I would urge you to consider House Bill 2008. It is important. Anybody have any questions?
We'll wait and we'll have questions at the end, but thank you for coming all the way from
Washington
City.
Thank you for letting me share.
Yeah.
Thank you, Madam Chair and the committee. I am Stephanie Lynn, and I also live in Longview Hills Park in Newport. It is a senior park, and I've been there for 12 years. I'm a business owner, and I own two radio stations in Newport, and I live in my home with my disabled husband. He's homebound and on oxygen, and also our adult daughter, Kelly. I'm supporting House Bill 2008, and I urge for the passage of this bill. We need it, and I'd like to illustrate my experience with filing a written complaint in my park. Last October, I filed a detailed, extensive, and serious complaint about the park management, Teresa and Terry Everest. I filled out the required form that was supplied to me by the owners. I gave as much detail as possible. Briefly, my complaint is over 3 pages long and began with a short trip to check my mail at the community center last January, a year ago, January. And I was accosted by a woman in the parking lot who was screaming at me, waving her arms and from the parking lot. And I'd never met this woman before, so I turned around and left immediately and went to work because I was not going to engage in someone screaming at me or I did not know. What the entire situation was, but about an hour later, my husband called from home. There was a 30-day eviction notice on my door. Went home to call my husband and get some answers, and the woman who was screaming was the new park manager. She'd been there about 2 months, but had never introduced herself to any of our residents. She thought I was speeding through the park, which is kind of hard to imagine in my 20-year-old Ford Explorer on a cold January morning going 2 blocks. But she gave a very detailed, extensive complaint about peeling rubber, flying gravel. It was pretty dramatic. And my only course against this eviction notice was to write an apology letter under duress and help calm my husband down because he was afraid we were going to be thrown out of our home. They didn't stop. They started stalking our home. We live on the end of a dead end. And they take a golf cart, and they had to make it a special trip to pass my home many times a day for 3 weeks. And then I got the next letter. And it was also serious and accused my of us having some strangers living in our home. And so I went to clear this up with the manager to explain that the people coming to my home were the two people who helped take care of my husband a couple hours a week. They're never there after 4 in the afternoon, so I don't know why she thought they were living there. And at this exchange, she insisted that there were a bunch of rules that are not in my rules. So the next item in my complaint to the owner was that this woman had insisted that my daughter could not live in our home. Again, the same situation that Elizabeth Dean had suffered with her family. And so I went in to register my daughter, update her. She'd been living in our home for 7 years. She's a nurse at the hospital. We went in to register. We were introduced to, brought into Teresa's office. And the office was covered with religious materials for her Bible study classes. And my daughter and I came into this small room, and she had to clear the table of the Bible verses, and the posters were everywhere, which is fine, except that then she invited my daughter to the Bible course, said, you should really come to our Bible classes. And now this is after you've been threatened with eviction. So it was a pretty uncomfortable situation. But we did fill those things out. We wrote up a complaint, and I gave the details, and I have copies of it. I submitted that at the end of October to Phil Taylor, HCA, the owners of the park, to let them know that what was going on with their manager.
Stephanie, will you try to wrap up your story?
Yes.
Fairly, just because there are a lot of people behind you.
I was one of the complaints that was ignored for 4 months. Mm-hmm. And this is why we need at least recording of complaints, because that should not have happened. And the other items in 2008 that I encourage include the providing materials for my neighbors so they understand what their rights are, the recording of the complaints, and most importantly, enforcement. Because neighbors, like in our park, we're very technically a full park compared to some. And I can't imagine what the other 62,000 people who run into some problems like this have to deal with when they have to hire attorneys, because that's the only way we have it. To think that there's any kind of board now or any kind of recourse, there is none. I have called many departments, and basically comes down to hire an attorney, and that can't happen. And I only have one other statement about the purchase of parks. In House Bill 2990. March 28th of 16, we received an undated notice from the park owner, Brian Fitterer, suggesting that our park may or may not be for sale. There was strong interest in a tenant purchase, so with the assistance of Terry Smith at CASA, I reacted quickly and formed a tenants purchase committee. CASA began the process of trying to make an offer and proceed from there. April 4th, well within the 10-day window, I notified Mr. Fitterer that we had a tenant purchase committee established, but I can tell you 10 days is no way near enough time. But we did it. And from that point on, CASA took the ball and prepared an offer. And our offer, our park was estimated to be valued at $7 to $8 million. And based on the recent sales of parks in Oregon, CASA recommended we come in high at $12 million. This offer was rejected. The owner told us he had an offer of $16 million. CASA and our committee returned to Fitterer and prepared to match that offer. But he refused because there just wasn't enough time. After the sale failed, we learned that the new owners and their managers assured people in our park that there was never any question of the tenant's purchase, as the deal was done before the letter was sent in March. Phil Taylor, HCA, paid over $16 million for a 177-space park worth about $12 million. at best. Now every effort is being made by the new owner and his managers to drive out the tenants with 99-year leases like mine and replace them with their 5-year leases that require capital improvement pass-throughs that are in violation of Chapter 90 laws. We asked CASA to investigate the sale of our park, but our messages were never returned. This process has failed us. We are very disappointed that we were not able to purchase our park, and living under the new managers and the new owners is really pretty horrible. Thank you.
Thank you, Stephanie, and thank you again for coming all the way from Lincoln City. And I hope you're putting everything in OLIS.
Yes.
Yes, thank you. Okay.
Thank you.
Charles.
Thank you.
Charles.
My name's Charlie, and I'm a resident. I live in Canyonville, right next to the casino, walking distance. It's a retirement community. It's a pretty well-to-do community. When I look at my home, I don't consider myself a renter, and I don't think any homeowner in a manufactured home park should be considered a renter. I paid for the home. I made an investment into that community, and I should be recognized that way. I am not. It's embarrassing, if you want to know the truth. And when I go to court to handle a problem, I'm treated as a renter. And I could be evicted, and it's just impossible to move a three-section manufactured home that is actually just as well stuck to the ground as a stick-built home. So that's my initial complaint as a resident. I have a history. I have been a member of MHOSTA for over 6 years. I have served on the board of directors for approximately 5 years. I have attended many, many coalition meetings. I am also was a member of the National MOHOA, and Rita wants me to go back and do that again. I have a reputation. I have been to many parks in this state, and I have come across many problems. I've never met these two ladies before, but listening to the situations they brought up, it's just the beginning. You're not hearing it. You're not going out there and seeing what we residents feel. When I walk into a park, I can't satisfy the residents' needs because I can't tell them that the law that we approved, that we wrote, and that I presented to the coalition 2 meetings ago, who are not willing to enforce those laws they write. We need a way to enforce the laws we write. We residents cannot depend upon a lawyer. Put me in the hands of a lawyer and I am screwed, if you want to know the truth. I'm in process of several different suits right now, one in my own park. I was told it was going to be maybe $3,000 because we were able to prove 2 things. We sued for the illegal sale of my property that after January 2015, we were supposed to be all notified as residents, not recognized as the committee. We were not notified until May of 2015, telling us that we would have new owners in June of 2015. I also am suing because we were overbilled for our utilities and waters. We had monthly bills. We never received monthly bills, as I should say that correctly. But we knew that we were paying utilities, sewer, and water, $72 for the sewer and $40 for the water. We found out that the water bill was less than half of that from the city of Canyonville. We proved it in black and white. Now, I started the suit over a year ago, and we are into it for $9,000. And we still haven't seen their purchase and sale agreement because they refused to present it, even though we got it ordered by the judge. We haven't finished this suit yet. It is also costs us up to $9,000, $10,000 at this point in time. What am I supposed to do to get my rights enforced? We can prove this. The lawyer said it's a done deal. We have the in black and white. These are what these ladies are complaining about. We're just the tip of the iceberg. I've been around the parks where residents in Bend are fined, consistently where the manager goes out in the middle of the night with a flashlight and looks in their garbage cans, measures where their car is parked, fines them up to $200 a month. When the renter goes to pay his rent and he can't afford to pay the fine at the same time, they won't take the rent. They evict. It is happening in Bend, Oregon, in several parks. That's illegal. What can they do? Half of them are immigrants. What happens to that fine money? There's no roster, no way of accounting for where that fine money goes. We know the two managers who came in with old trucks have two new trucks within 2 years. We know that. They took the initiative to go out in the middle of the night with flashlights looking in people's windows to find these people. We know who's profiting. We can prove it. But I can't get the lawyers to work for me. It costs too much money. The people don't have it. Why do people in parks live in fear? Whether they're 25-year-olds living in a manufactured park or 80-year-olds living in a manufactured park, because they're in fear of being evicted. It happens every day. Your managers are not school trained. Your managers and a good percentage of these parks have no training at all. They have no communication skills at all. They don't treat us with respect. They think they have power. Remember, I bought a home. I'm living there. I am supposed to be provided a service. If I maintain my property, I'm doing everything correct. I live by the rules and regulations. Why am I treated with disrespect? This manager can't even fill out a lease agreement properly because he cannot explain it or she cannot explain it to the person who's moving in. These managers have no training at all. And yet they do the job of a realtor. They do the job basically of a lawyer, counseling and everything else, threatening with eviction notices and things like that. They're supposed to be landscape qualified. They're supposed to be construction qualified. All these skills that I would have had to pay for to get into professions and possibly 4 years of school education, these managers, what, they get 4 years, 4 hours?
Charlie.
I've attended that class. There's 2 hours possibly of updates and 2 hours of bull because they talk about how bad their residents are to the instructor.
Charlie, can you wrap it up so we can let other people?
Oh, I could go on all day long.
It looks like you could.
I attend these coalition meetings.
So please
meetings.
Wrap it up.
Wrap it up. Okay. I attend the coalition meetings, and I think a lot more could be done if you allow the coalition meeting only to participants only to be OSTA and the management courses. Why? Because they're more in tune to what is needed. You keep the lawyers and the owners out of there and the property managers out of there. You'll get more done. They interfere, they stop progress. You know, at the coalition meeting, although I respect John a lot, I've worked with him, I have a good time with him, but they won't talk about rent control and they won't talk about enforcement. Those are the two key things that are going to save our butts. I got a new owner from California. One more minute.
Last.
I got a new owner
about
from
10
California.
Seconds.
You talk about rent increases. Yeah. Just bought my property illegally. But when the new resident comes in now, they're paying $70 to $100 more than I am. That's ridiculous, because they're not doing any more than the previous person.
Charlie, thank you.
We need to work on rent controls.
Thank you for coming.
Thank you for your
Douglas
time.
County.
I get loud, I get boisterous, but I'm also very passionate about what I'm saying.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay, next up we've got Ty Downing, Rich Delaney, and how about Cheryl Stassi?
I know, he just lost everything.
Pink. Ty, this. Charles, and Cheryl.
Hi.
Okay. Once you start.
Hi, good morning. I'm Richard Delaney. I'm a mobile home park owner. I'm a real estate broker, and I'm a CPA. As such, I broker and operate parks in Washington, Oregon, and several other states. I've been doing this for 36 years. I want to talk about 2990 and use it as an example of how one side or a partial answer is probably the wrong solution. The bill, as written, eliminates the option for an owner to do a 1031 exchange. The IRS allows a buyer 45 days to select a property. He has to identify that property within 45 days. That's a federal law, and it's a tax requirement. The entire process of this 2990 was negotiated extensively in 2014. And that rule and that set of rules was negotiated by the Landlord-Tenant Committee. Not everybody got everything they wanted, but it was a workable solution. The simple change of going from 10 days to 60 days precludes the option of a 1031 exchange. In my experience, any property that's over $1 million probably involves a 1031 exchange on one side or another. Typically in Oregon, that means a park of 16 to 20 spaces. It's a hard line to walk. Some of the stories are heart-wrenching. Sometimes I don't tell people I'm from California. You people think everybody from California is a crook. It's not really true. But it's a hard line to walk. We have to have some kind of a meeting of the minds. We have to have a coalition. And if we just have one side of the story, it's not going to work. Mobile home parks are not the problem. Yes, there are instances and so on, but statewide, most of the rents are about $500. I don't know where else you can live in this area for $500. In fact, in many areas for that price. Another thing, the people typically who live in mobile home parks can afford their lifestyle. I run a program that has 8,000 spaces involved. If a person doesn't meet the federal poverty level standards, they can qualify for and receive a rent subsidy, and the park pays for it. We're not asking you to pay. This didn't have to go through any revenue thing at the state of Oregon. The park pays for it. The results, and this program has been in operation for 3 years, less than 1% of the people qualify and need the subsidy. I think my message is we're part of the solution, but we need to work together on it, and a one-sided legislative approach doesn't work.
Before you move on, I noticed on when in the sign-in sheets that you signed up against House Bill 2990, 3330, 3331, but you put for House Bill 2008. Did you want to comment on any?
Made a mistake.
That was a mistake. That was supposed to be a no.
As short as
I didn't know if you were liking some parts of the bill more than others.
Okay. I made a mistake.
Okay. Thank you very much.
In haste.
Okay.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee, for the opportunity to be here today. I'm Ty Downing. I bought my first community in 2010 in a 1031 exchange, by the way. It was a fixer. It was practically a non-functional park, and it practically bankrupted my wife and I during the 3 years that we spent rehabilitating the property. Even so, I kept my rents low. The space rents at my park right now today in close-in southeast Portland are $500 a month. It's water, sewer, and garbage included. Because as park operators, our business model dictates that we not push our rents too much, because when a resident gets evicted or abandons a home, that empty home becomes a non-performing liability and we lose money. And I've learned to make that point because not everybody understands how parks work. We're not like apartments. We are absolutely different. We can't just plug a renter in there. So therefore, we don't push hard rent increases to our residents. And by the way, we have the data at MHCO. I think you actually have the data as well now. We take care of our residents. I don't know one park owner that won't work with a resident to resolve an issue and give them a little extra time to catch up on owed rent, or stretch deadlines for compliance on improvement issues, except in certain instances where extra time given means we run afoul of specific state statutes and waive our right as property owners to enforce rules and regulations, and that hurts the entire community. In fact, the coalition right now is working on some of these issues where we have mutual interests. I started attending coalition meetings 1 year ago. I was pretty surprised at the depth of the conversation that happens there. There's a lot of time spent on this stuff because mobile home park landlord-tenant law is complicated. And John Van Landingham, as much as I cringe sometimes when he starts talking about wanting to regulate everything, that guy, he's smart. He's really smart. He knows the issues. He knows both sides of them, and he's super effective at keeping this coalition productive to forge win-win outcomes. And by win-win, I mean nobody's happy. I was really pleased that we were able to bring the coalition back together. That's a good thing. If you don't attend, it's kind of difficult to understand just how valuable it is to work through these issues together because they are substantial. Here's the thing. It's becoming super challenging to operate a successful community because of the regulatory burden. Most of us are mom-and-pop operators. We own one or two parks. And it's come to the point where to even send out a basic notice to a resident, I have to send it to my mobile home park specialist attorney first to make sure that it complies with the state laws. And even these guys, much smarter than me, who've been doing this for a long time, they don't even necessarily have this stuff memorized. I mean, it's expensive. It's tough. And $29.90, I'm kind of stunned that we're even seeing this before us. This issue's been negotiated extensively with the residents. And frankly, in my opinion, the whole notice of sale issue is a little bit condescending to everybody. This is a free market. Our residents aren't ignorant. They know exactly what they're getting into. They know that any property is potentially for sale at all times. We all know that. That's the way things work in America. They know exactly that in exchange for living on rented land, they'll get in return the least expensive housing, period. I mean, we're it. And we're here by choice. I mean, I don't have to invest in and rehabilitate Oregon mobile home parks. There's other markets out there, and a lot of us are, we're all talking about it. We're all looking at other markets now. That's not good for Oregon. I'm a native Oregonian. I love the state. On May 1st, I'm throwing down the biggest purchase I've made so far, buying a 74-space, half-vacant manufactured home community in Roseburg. It's an off-market opportunity that I've been chasing for over 2 years. Me and two other investor partners plan to bring in 30 homes over the next 2 to 3 years as we rebuild this community, and I get to live in Roseburg part-time. Like, literally, the plan is 3 nights a week, I'm there, hands-on, with all my tools, my trailers, all my stuff. And I've got young kids at home in Portland. This is not my first choice to be in Roseburg, but I'm excited about the opportunity. I want to build this community. So point is, I'm all in. I'm all in. I'm an MHCO board member. I'm a licensed real estate broker who specializes in parks, and I love what I do. I'd like to see the state step up. If we're truly in a housing emergency, where are the supply side bills? Why are those of us who are actually providing affordable housing being labeled as the problem? Is it because there's only a few hundred of us as owners and we're like the weakest landlord lobby that there is? I don't know. Let's talk about surplus land. Let's talk about reducing system development fees. Let's talk about expanding urban growth boundaries, increasing density. Let's build housing. But let us do what we do best. Thank you.
Thank you, and stay tuned on April 6th because we're hearing a lot of those bills. Okay, thank you.
Hello, my name is Cheryl Stassi-Lampman, and I am a resident in a very small mobile home park in Eugene, Oregon. It's called Falconwood Village. And I'm here to really talk about rent control and also the impact on senior citizens. In the park I reside in, probably 45% of the individuals that reside there in their 80s. Most are on very, very fixed incomes and have seen increases in their rents in the last 2 years of approximately 8 years of approximately $200. For a senior on Social Security and a reduced income, that's very expensive. I think that sometimes we get carried away with thinking that mobile home parks, and I appreciate hearing from others because I've only resided in this park for 8 years. But the thing that I think is overwhelming for me is seeing people lose their hope. And in the park I reside in, people have lost their hope. So we have created we have really rejuvenated our association. We're bringing back our OSTA group, our committee of seven, to really attempt to get something I don't want to just say something done in our community, but we want to move along. Anyway, where I see the disconnect is between the large company that owns my park, it's Equity Lifestyles, and their corporate offices are in Chicago, Illinois. They're a billion-dollar corporation. And the disconnect is with the manager that they have sitting to work in their space. Many of the things that the prior individual spoke to about threatening behaviors, people living in fear, is how the park that I reside in is. Those senior citizens are afraid, and that's no way for us to treat the elderly in our communities. And I think that the more we can look at that connection between owners and the people that they put into their parks to manage those parks. Training them in fiscal management is one thing. Training them in how to get along with people and how to operate within a community is a big deal. My last job was with the state of Oregon, and I licensed foster homes for adults with developmental disabilities. Those homes were monitored and were licensed on an annual basis, and people were able to see what was going on, and those property owners had to fix up their homes to be able to provide supports. I believe that that needs to happen within our parks. I believe that this park especially needs to have individuals that run it that know how to care about people, and that's not happening. And I don't know how to make the connect in the coalition. I've attended one meeting, and it was interesting, to say the least. So that's about all I have to say, but our rents have been increased. And I'd like to see the what is the bill that is
3330 is lifting the statewide exemption.
Right, and then the enforcement is even more important, is ensuring that people have a vehicle to make complaints and be able to feel like they have an avenue of somebody listening to them. Because when I went door to door in our park, we have about 180, and I took them all the bills, and there were five individuals that gave me letters and said that they wanted their letters to come forward to this committee because they felt that it was really important that people understood who they are as people. And sometimes that does not happen when we're looking at litigation and laws that, and I know that that's your focus, but I also am hoping that you hear the people piece.
So please put them in OLIS. Did you have a question?
Yeah, I do. Yes. Thank you, Madam Chair. So my question is actually directed to Richard and Ty. I mean, do both of you, I guess I need a follow-up question too with this. Really quick, both of you have managers working for you in your parks?
I'm a manager. I don't own all of these parks. I own parts of some of them, and I own all of others. But typically, I work for other people. I'm the hired man.
Okay.
In each park, we have an on-site manager. We belong to MHCO. Our managers go to the classes. I typically spend Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday on the road in the parks. I show up unannounced. I handle, if complaints come in, they go to my desk. I handle those problems. We have two nines that are handled by a person who two nine space parks that are handled by a person who does not live on site. But other than that, We have an on-site manager, and I believe that's essential to good management. I also believe you got to check up on them. That's why I follow.
What do you mean check up? Check up on the managers or
show
the
up.
Okay.
Follow up. You got to answer questions, and you got to show up unannounced.
Okay. Time.
Currently, my parks are on the small to medium size, and pretty much for the reasons we've talked about, the complexity of the law, I haven't found people that reside in the park currently that I'd be comfortable with letting handle a single notice. So I self-manage all my parks. My one in Portland is 28 spaces, 44 spaces in Gold Beach, and then there's one that I talked about. I give every resident when I sign up, when I take over a park, I give every resident my phone number and encourage them to call me. And in fact, I tell them, don't bug the on-site person. They are eyes and ears to report to me, and they are collecting the rents, and that's it. That's the responsibility they have. And that's pretty much solely for the reason that there's just so much to all this that it's all I can do to do it correctly, and there's no way I'm gonna step out of compliance by having somebody who means well. So I just tell them, don't even get involved. The message is always call Ty.
So just really quick. It appears that it'd be essential then to, I mean, if you are doing that as a manager or folks in a park, that you'd have good personal and interpersonal skills.
I hope so.
Go without that, yeah.
But I've made some mistakes. Obviously, I made one this morning.
Wow. That's penmanship.
It's important for our jobs, too. It's important for everyone.
Well, you're talking about people's skills on our end as managers. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I put a lot of focus on that. Respecting the residents is the day number one. And, I was struggling not too many years ago, like when I bought my first park. I mean, I know what it's like to struggle. I keep that. There's always got to be respect first, and I give people chances. It's very clear. I lay out for them the framework to cure anything that needs to be cured. But they have an opportunity typically, unless it's totally egregious behavior, which in my parks, thankfully, I've only had to deal with a few times. Usually we can find a solution. So I'm very solution focused.
Thank you.
Thank you.
This just seems to be a very consistent issue with larger parks. I appreciated them saying that they were available. We cannot even make a phone call to our manager and have him reply. He is totally unavailable all the time. Knocking on his office door doesn't get anything either. So I appreciate what they're saying about them wanting to work. But I think the disconnect is between large corporations that are owning parks within the state of Oregon and who they have managing those parks.
Thank you very much.
Madam Speaker?
Yes.
Vice Chair Sanchez also.
Representative Sanchez.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have several questions.
Okay. And we have other people coming up.
I know. I just want to, very quickly, if you could. So I know nothing about manufactured homes, but I took the concerns of a gentleman here before, Charlie, I believe it is. In terms of them purchasing a home, so you all mentioned your realtors as well. And I think about this because when I bought my home many, many, many years ago, it was about the same price as manufactured home. How long do they last? How long do they last? How does somebody buy it? Is it already sitting there? Do they buy it and then place it there? And then once they do that, I cannot articulate the feeling that when you said, Ty, they know what they're getting into.
Yeah. Yeah, I have residents. I just had one like last week ask, is there any plans to sell the park? And I'm showing them our statement of policy and rules and regulations before they apply. That's a not uncommon question. Any plans to sell the park? It is my sense that people understand that is a possibility. I feel strongly. I mean, I've worked so hard for what I have. I feel pretty strongly that I think there's some initiative that should be taken to understand, you know, of course, what you're getting into, and to, if you think you want to buy the park, that's a great idea. So, you know, getting to your question about the homes lasting. We have some homes in my park that are quite old, late 60s, being nursed along. Some people have come in and remodeled them recently to the skins, like new joists. It's kind of incredible what can be done. That said, any home built in the 60s or 70s, if it hasn't been vastly remodeled, it's at its the end of its useful life cycle. And it's an interesting industry that we're in because the new homes, back in pre-2000, homes used to come in. Dealers used to make deals and bring homes in, and residents used to bring homes in because there was financing in place. There was a subprime meltdown in the manufactured housing sector that preceded the one we all know about by about 10 years, and it just destroyed financing completely for manufactured housing. So those days are largely over. As an experiment, I brought in a brand new home into my park, single wide, covered porch, beautiful home, all the extras, all the bells and whistles, and even in the hottest market on the planet, just about. It took a few months to sell it because the financing is, I'm not sure that I'll do it again. I didn't make any money. We don't make money on the homes. It's all about the space rent. So it's kind of an experiment. So there's some interesting issues there for sure. But basically, a home that's properly sited and habitable is has some good value. That's another thing that's happening right now in the market is so you have these space rents that are low, but the home values now, because of the housing issues, home values are rising. I've had a couple of younger people now that have come in. This is what I'm talking about, people that are aware of the situation and thinking about how can I better myself. They come in, buy these homes for, in one instance, a guy bought it for $7,000 and sold it, put some money into it and sold it for like $13,000. The new record in my park for an old single wide is $20,000. That just happened. They went hard on that house and did a lot to it, but point being, there is true equity there. Those people, even though they put a lot of money into it, they made money on that. So, and my space rents have been going like this, but the home prices, even in a mobile home park, are coming up. So, there's some interesting things at play. It's a unique little niche that we're in. Mm-hmm.
So, follow up. Thank you, Madam Chair. It is that investment piece that I sort of struggle with because as I said, my home was very low price way back in the day when I bought it, and that the fact that people actually invested in those homes and feel in some way, shape, or form that they can't keep it where it is. How much does it cost to move one?
Maybe I can add to that and I can supplement it a little bit. Typically, in Oregon, moving a single wide costs maybe $7,000, moving a double wide costs $12,000. But the truth is, that's not what happens. Nobody moves a home unless they hate the manager and if they're doing it on spite. It is not economic. That is a sunk, dead cost. In reality, the homes are sold in place. And typically, they are sold by a real estate broker. That's not what's legal, but that's generally what happens. Theoretically, they're supposed to be sold by a mobile home dealer if they're in a mobile home park. Typically, prices vary by condition. The great bulk of the mobile homes in Oregon probably are below $25,000. Certainly, you talk about some of the great parks, and those aren't the average parks. But those homes can go as high as $100,000. But the typical bulk of the homes are the $25,000 things. Now, the other thing that I want to comment on, you ask a little bit about the right of buying a mobile home park.
No, actually. I wasn't referring to the park. So it's
the actual homes.
Just
the mobile home. Okay.
Yes.
So let's do
one more.
One more question, and then
Madam
I want to make
Chair.
Sure we have time for the last. I think there are five people left to go.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair. Just wanted to address the question or the subject you brought about 1031 exchanges. So my question is that if you're going to be able to, if a mobile home or manufactured home park owner can sell and execute a 1031 exchange. Whether the buyer, is a private party or the park, the owner of the property should still be able to execute that 1031 exchange. But are you saying that it would hamper the potential buyer of the manufactured home park?
What it does, it destroys the liquidity in the market. Currently, if someone owns a property, whether it's any real estate property, they need to have some willing and able buyer. The bulk of the buyers for larger properties are 1031 buyers. So moving this deadline from 10 days to 60 closes that option for people who own parks. Ultimately, That can only lead to one thing, which is a lack of liquidity in parks and a decline in the number of parks in Oregon.
Follow up, Madam Chair. Yeah, because, well, I mean, I'm in the middle of 1031 exchange myself. I've helped several, you know, clients do 1031 exchanges. And I don't understand what time frame would work. 45 days? Because I know
there's
that
two time frames in a 1031 exchange. The first one is you have 45 days to identify the buy property, and you have 180 days to close. Both of those are hard line numbers.
Mm-hmm. Well, then I don't understand where the 60 days would interfere.
If you have somebody that's going to wait for 60 days, they can't do that on a 1031 exchange. Their time is up. Their time lapses before the 60 days.
So if we made it 30 days, would that work?
It would
or
be 40, better.
45.
Or 45, yeah.
But yeah. 45 won't work. Nobody's going to sit around and wait until the last day to see whether or not they got a deal.
Yeah, well,
you're drying up the liquidity.
Yeah, I totally understand it. But my biggest concern is that we can't, are we going to eliminate the park buyers the opportunity to buy it? Because if your main goal as a seller is to sell it at market rate. And if we can sell it at market rate to folks that help them stabilize their community, what's wrong with that? And that's all I'm saying.
There's nothing wrong with that. And that's why I wanted to comment a little bit about the ability to buy. The most important thing you can do to encourage people to buy is provide money. I've been in deals where CASA looked at it and said, no, they can't do it because they don't have the money. CASA can only do what the money allowed is. And they have a problem because they don't have the money.
So I do want to say those are also bills that were
okay.
That we are that we passed a $25 million out of this committee revolving loan fund for groups like CASA to increase home ownership.
That would enable them to buy more parks.
That's right. So that's part of the solution.
You know, the state of Oregon does is it gives a tax relief on the income tax for the seller.
Capital gains tax.
In effect, if CASA buys a park, they get a subsidy that's typically equal to 10% of the purchase price from the state of Oregon already.
That's right, which is a great bill that we want to extend to other property owners.
Right.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Okay, good. So next we have Dale Strom, Adam Cook, and Corey Poole. And then we'll have two people after you. We do go beyond 9:45, so... We get about 5 minutes each, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh. Regular.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Dale Strom. I want to give you a little bit of history about me first before I tell you what I am as far as a landlord. I am a current board member of MHCO. I'm a past president and the current treasurer of that body.
Say what MHCO is for everyone.
The Manufactured Housing Communities of Oregon. Okay. Chuck Carpenter is our executive director. 1962, my parents built, owned, and actively managed their first apartment complex. 1972, they purchased Country Manor in Springfield, Oregon. That was 1972. During that time, I helped out my father mowing fields, putting up fences, putting up signs, and also I remember on ledger paper writing down, marking down the rents that were paid by the tenants. So, 1992, I became a partner in that community. 2006, I purchased my first community in Clatskanie, River Bend Manufactured Home Park. And in 2012, I purchased Deer Point Meadows. Wanted to go tell you a little bit about what it is that that I have to deal with is being a landlord. There's many issues that need to be brought to the table. I have to deal with septic issues, septic systems that are failing. I'm working with DEQ on repairing those. I have park lighting issues where the lighting, if it's not that good in the park, I as a landlord have to take care of those kind of issues. I have abandonment issues. Every time somebody passes away in the park, leaving nobody as owner, somebody walks away from the park, I have to go to my attorney, follow the abandonment guidelines that is in Chapter 90. That's a minimum of $450 that I pay my attorney to file the proper papers in order to get a storage agreement going. It goes from a tenancy to a storage agreement when I have an abandoned issue. I wanted to talk about late rents, that they occur all the time. Charlie, spoke a little while ago about not getting rents, filing that I have to go file an FED, which means I have to go to the courthouse, file an FED on late rents. I have to go to the sheriff's department to have them serve those papers to the people that aren't paying the rents. When I go into court, the first thing that the judge wants us to do is go outside, see if we can work out an agreement on our FEDs, and you know, in cases like this. A lot of times I have problems with tenants that are late, promising to do something, and sometimes they skip out, leaving me with unpaid rent or other issues where I try to work out with them payment agreements going forward and how we can keep those people there. I have issues with assistance animals that really aren't assistance animals. I get a lot of times people saying, I had an issue where somebody said that they had I needed an assistance animal for a physical abnormality that they had. Well, it found out that the breed of the dog of an assistance animal that was there had pit bull type. It was part pit bull, which was an aggressive animal in the park, and I had to evict that tenant with the dog after it killed a neighbor's cat. I want to also let you know about people or tenants that do not pay their utility fees. A lot of utilities require me as a landlord to pick up those utility fees, and I picked up several bills that of water that was used by tenants that I paid the city of Clatskanie because, again, some tenants that skipped the town that used water did not pay their bills. I was on the hook for that, and that's part of what I have to face, have to agree to the city of Clatskanie in order to allow water into my park.
So I'll make sure you get a chance to say what you feel about the bills, and I'm assuming that you're against, although okay. You marked in favor.
Yes, I am. Oh, I just wanted to let you know, I'm here in support of Chuck and John Van Lanningham getting together and all the other tenants associations and landlords associations getting together. I have a long laundry list, and you want me to speed it up. I get that, all right? I just wanted to let you know the things that I deal with. I heard a lot of anecdotal evidence about what some of these tenants are saying do happen. Yes, FEDs do happen. Tenants do not pay their rent. You know, tenants are not all responsible as well as I realize not all landlords are responsible as well. You know, I just wanted to let you know that, first of all, there are things that I have to deal with. Mm-hmm. That aren't pleasant, that doesn't make my job as a landlord that easy. I do want to say that I like the coalition getting together so we can hammer out our issues, our differences, and things that need to be addressed. I don't like these five bills that came in without us being able to discuss it with John Van Lanningham. Discuss it between ourselves as a board on how we're going to proceed with this sort of thing. I just wanted to let you know that I feel like I am a responsible landlord. I'm proud of the job that I do, and I'm proud of what I can do for people that need affordable housing.
Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you.
Good morning, Chair Kenny Geyer and members of the committee. My name is Adam Cook. I'm a resident of Oregon City and own some communities in Milwaukee. I'm 25 years I've been involved in the property management business. I currently own and as a president of Commonwealth Real Estate Services, which is a property management company that specializes in manufactured home community management. We've been in business for 33 years. I'm also a long-term board member of MHCO, Manufactured Housing Communities of Oregon. I've been on the board for 18 years, and I've also been involved in the Landlord-Tenant Coalition meetings for the past 20 years off and on through Commonwealth, our company. I'm also a second-generation manufactured home community owner. My uncle and my father had the good foresight to, when they got out of the asphalt paving business, they decided to redevelop the land that rock quarry used to occupy in Milwaukee. And we now have a 186-unit manufactured home community that allows residents of all ages in that community. And then we also have a senior community that's 61 home sites in a neighboring property. And I can tell you that those are larger properties by the standards of the state of Oregon. Our management company manages about 65 properties in Oregon, and also we have experience in Washington, too. We're the largest management company specializing in manufactured home communities in Oregon and Washington, and we've seen all kinds of situations that come up with resident issues, but we also have managers that are very well trained. So in Oregon, they go to the training sessions that are mandated by the state, but in addition to that, Commonwealth provides additional training for our managers in a three-tiered phase, and then, of course, training is ongoing. They're constantly going through that process. So I think the training does work, and I think that our managers, particularly even at the larger communities, are in tune with our resident needs. That's one of our focuses. Our family's community has been operating very successfully over the years. We have one of the higher rents in the Southeast Portland area, but it's partly due because it's one of the newest communities, and it's also one of the nicest communities. With no disrespect to the other communities in the area, we really put a lot of money back into the property, and we want it to look nice, and we have residents that move to our community because of the fact that it's well maintained. After they search around, they come to us and say, this is the nicest one I could find. And so we're very proud of that fact, and we're proud to be affordable housing providers, and also proud to be in this industry. But I can tell you that my family, we meet periodically to talk about things, and one of the things that's been discussed recently has been this onslaught of what I would view as an attack on manufactured housing. I don't think a lot of the things, although they're well-intended, I don't think that they will accomplish what you would want to see happen. And I think it would drive good investors out of the market and operators such as ourselves out of the market. I think that the fact that there hasn't been a new manufactured home community built in Oregon that I'm aware of since the year 2000, I think speaks volumes as to the lack of a viability of a financial model that would work for a developer to build manufactured home communities. So I'm glad to hear that there are some bills maybe in the works for that. I wanted to talk a little bit about the Landlord-Tenant Coalition. I have the unfortunate disadvantage to come and follow John and Chuck, who have talked about some of the things that we've accomplished. So I tried to key on a few things that we did talk about that I think are important. It was brought up that there's a statement of policy. A statement of policy is a disclosure document that's offered to all residents at the application process so that they are informed before they move into a community so that they can make an informed decision about whether they want to move into a community. And it does offer that 5-year rent history. So it does show you through course of performance how that property performs or how what its policies are in terms of issuing rent increases. So it'll give you a good indication of what the future would hold. We respond to the issues that we need to deal with, and it's not uncommon for the legislature to hear about some situations that need to be addressed and have them referred to us. A good example was Senator Bonamici referred Senate Bill 929 to us to deal with submetering, and we talked about it ad nauseum, and A couple sessions later, we worked on it again. And I think that it's going to need to be worked on yet again, because we've, as you go through this and you work through the issues, become experts at what works and what doesn't work, you realize that there are things that can be fixed. And I think we're at a point where we realize that there's some additional tweaks that we can make to that section to make it better. And last session, we worked on a situation where we had property taxes, in particular in certain counties, where there was a large tax balance that was owing. And I'm aware of one in Washington County that was in a community that we managed, about $40,000 in back taxes. Well, the home's not worth $40,000. So it really limits what you can do. We were able to successfully get an affidavit process where the county will concede and cancel those taxes if the home is valued at under $8,000 in exchange for the owner not profiting through the sale of that home ultimately when they rehab it. And that's what ultimately has to happen. There's nobody moving manufactured home communities into our communities to fill vacancies anymore. We have to do that ourselves. And as Ty mentioned, that's a losing money proposition for us. So we go through that. We just want to get it back on the market, provide that affordable housing to somebody, and then have the rent start coming back in so that it pays for the effort of having gone through it. So one community that we're involved in Umatilla, got involved with it about 2.5 years ago. The property took out a huge loan on the property. It had deferred maintenance. It had lots of economic vacancies in the property, abandoned homes and vacant spaces, hazard trees everywhere. The streets were in shambles, and they needed to be repaved. The property reinvested well over $150,000 back into the property and all these different improvements. And I'm proud to say that we've have a net increase in those 2 years of 15 more residents in that community than we used to have. The property looks great, and it's now very appealing to residents to move to in the community. I bring that up only because I want to point out that I don't think that kind of reinvestment in the community will occur if there were some form of rent control that would limit an owner's ability to recover those costs in over the long term. And also, I can tell you that I know of a community owner who was a former client of ours now, who, when he was aware of some of the legislation that was before us this session, chose to sell all three of his communities and, in a sense, exited our industry. And he was a very good operator, but was very concerned about what it looked like was happening here. So I just want to reiterate how important the work of the coalition is. We are the experts in our industry. We know what problems we face, and we appreciate it when something is brought to us to work on. We don't always see eye to eye on all the issues, but at least we can get them out on the table. We can discuss them and come up with what we think is a fair compromise. So I encourage you to allow us to continue to work through the coalition, and thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Hi, I'll try to keep it relatively brief. My name is Corey Poole. I am an MHCO board member. I'm a third-generation owner-operator of Paradise Island Manufactured Home Park here in Salem, and all due respect, I think I also have one of the nicest parks in the area. My family has owned and operated our park since my grandfather built it over 50 years ago. Over the decades, we've worked really hard to keep space rent reasonable and keep our services high. We work face-to-face with our residents to find solutions to issues that come up every day. In over 50 years, we have not had a single eviction of a resident. That is something we are very proud of, and it is proof of the effectiveness of communication and compromise. In a similar way, the Landlord-Tenant Coalition has worked over the years to create a forum for tenants and landlords to come together and to seek these mutually agreeable resolutions to the problems that face us. I've not liked everything that's come out of the coalition personally, but that is a measure of the coalition's success, I feel. When laws and regulations are passed on our industry, without the input of park owners, it disproportionately impacts the smaller family-owned parks. Mine is not terribly small, but we only have one. Large out-of-state management companies can easily manage the legal hurdles that the state might put before them. Small park owners, as you've heard today, cannot easily absorb the legal fees and, frankly, live in fear of running afoul of one of the laws that maybe they didn't understand the implementation. I know I wind up calling the lawyer for stuff that I'm pretty sure I know what to do, but I wound up shelling out a few $100 because I just want to be sure. You know, I don't think I'm doing anything wrong, but I just want to be sure I'm dotting all those I's and crossing all those T's in just the right way when I'm working with my customers. I hear my customers telling me every day that they're glad that I'm available on site to meet them and help them with everything from picking up their garbage to getting their TV to work when they can't figure out why the remote's on the wrong channel or something like that. And I really hope you can help us as park owners continue to operate by helping us strengthen coalition and creating this ability for us to solve our problems instead of just going over our heads. It really makes a big difference.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay, we've got two last people, Courtney Seipel and Cameron Harrington. Courtney, why don't you start?
Thank you. Good morning, Chair Kenny Geyer, members of the committee. My name is Courtney Seipel, here on behalf of the Oregon Park Owners Alliance. Unfortunately, we were not included in the conversation last night to amend House Bill 2008, so until we see an amendment, we do not have we will not support or oppose the bill. The board will make that determination after seeing the amendment. I'm happy to answer any questions you have. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning, Chair Kenny Geyer and members of the committee. My name is Cameron Harrington. I work in the Cully neighborhood of Northeast Portland in Representative Sanchez's district. Cully is home to six manufactured housing parks. And they, as we've heard, they provide probably the most affordable housing in the Cully neighborhood and some of the most affordable housing in the city of Portland. Those six parks in Cully are home to over 400 households. Low-income families, working families, older adults, people with disabilities, people of color, folks who don't have other options in the housing market in a place like Portland. And so when we hear park owners say that residents can come into a park and read the rules and look at the history of rent increases and make an informed decision about if this is a good situation for them, that's not the situation at the mobile home parks in Cully. People are moving into these parks because they don't have other choices. This is the first step out of homelessness for many families, or it's the last stop before homelessness for others. And I'm here to talk about today why House Bill 2990 will go a long way to creating more balance and creating an opportunity for these families to have stability and predictability in their housing that they don't have today. The opportunity to purchase that exists under state law now is intended to even out an extreme imbalance in power between those who rely on manufactured housing as their only option for a stable home and the property owners who, by making one decision, can send hundreds of families into chaos by selling a park or shutting down a park. And that was a situation that we faced in the Cully neighborhood last year. I'm a community organizer. I work on the ground with families facing housing crises. And last year, about this time, we were in the midst of a major crisis in the Cully neighborhood. The Oakleaf Mobile Home Park was home to 35 families. It's owned by an out-of-state property owner who rarely set foot in Portland, who had no communication with the residents. And we started to hear rumors from residents in February of 2016 that the park was going to be sold and shut down and redeveloped with higher-end housing. In November of 2016, after a long fight, we were able to preserve the Oakleaf Park and keep it open as permanently affordable housing for the current residents and for future generations of low-income folks. The paradox of this situation is that the only reason we were able to do this was because the landlord broke the state law that exists to protect the residents. The landlord did not give the residents the required notice of her intent to sell the park, and that created legal liability that allowed the residents the time and space they needed to organize themselves together and to seek the support of nonprofit partners such as my organization, CASA of Oregon, and ultimately St. Vincent de Paul, to put together a plan to preserve the park. It also gave them time to go to Portland City Hall and lobby the Housing Bureau to put up the funds to preserve the park. And these residents of the Oak Leaf are really my heroes. They
1 minute.
They came together and fought to save their homes in the face of homelessness. If the landlord had followed the state law and provided them the notice of her intent to sell the park, there is no way that these residents in 10 days would have been able to do what it took them months to do, which is organize together, recruit the support of a variety, complex web of nonprofits, learn about their legal rights under this law, go to the city and get the Housing Bureau to commit to finance the acquisition. There's no way that could have happened. It was only because the landlord didn't follow the law that they were able to do this. So extending this period of time to 60 days is an essential protection to preserve affordable housing and providing residents with a right of first refusal to execute these preservation deals is also essential.
Great. Thank you. Thank you very much. We've run out of time. Thank you, committee. We've got a big dose of learning about manufactured homes. Thank you, everyone, for coming to testify. Glad the coalition has gotten together and look forward to continue work on these bills. I'm going to close the work session, public hearings on House Bill 2990, 2008, 3331, 3330, and the committee is adjourned. 330, and the committee is adjourned. 333.